This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. We talked recently about economic development here in Northwest Indiana. The most recent conversation that we had was with Spiros Batistatos, who is with the South Shore Convention and Visitors Authority, about the plans, I should say the study that was done and the plans that have been underway to look into the possibility of creating a new countywide convention center. Let's take a look at some bigger plans, and a region-wide plan that is being proposed by another Northwest Indiana agency. Several Northwest Indiana organizations have been working toward improving the economy and enhancing the quality of place through the creation of a region-wide plan. Lakeshore Public Radio Sharon Jackson recently talked with Heather Ennis, who's the president and CEO of the Northwest Indiana Forum, about the development of a region-wide plan through the forum and the goals of it.
For those who don't know, can you tell us what the Northwest Indiana Forum is and what its purpose is?
Sure. So we are the voice of Northwest Indiana business and the 7-county economic development organization covering Lake, Porter, LaPorte, Jasper, Newton, Pulaski, and Stark counties. So it is our job to tell the story of Northwest Indiana, going out and promoting the region, attracting businesses to come here, acting as the voice of Northwest Indiana business from a public policy perspective, as well as bringing together parties and operating as a united front for developing a vision for the region and helping to work with partners across the region to really capitalize on the opportunities that we have here in the region. So
tell me about the Northwest Indiana Forum and the development of the Regional Economic Development Strategic Playbook.
Yeah, so it's been a while in the process. We've been working on this. Initially, we were kind of reorganizing the strategic plan of the forum, but then we realized economic development works with a broad base of partners and a broad base of opportunities to move all of these assets together and move the partnerships together more cohesively. So we have not had an economic development regional plan previously. We've got the 2040 plan and we've got the Marquette plan. We've got other plans that have great goals and aspirations, but not anything that cohesively works economic development all together and what that means and how we're all operating together. So we went through the process of bringing in an outside consultant to talk with us about this because, of course, it's nice to get some perspective on it. Sometimes we can't see the forest through the trees, and having an outside company come in and look helps us to really evaluate the opportunities that are right here in front of us. So we went through a pretty stringent vetting process to bring on TIP strategies, and we're extremely excited about them. They came very highly recommended from people all over the country, and they've been engaged in a wide variety of opportunities such as this. But mostly, the thing that we found, two points that we found very exciting about them, is that they'd worked over large geographical areas that had varied interests and multiple jurisdictions, similarly to the makeup of Northwest Indiana. And then on the back end, they really produce a pragmatic playbook that helps give timelines and action items, and so it's an action-oriented plan. It's not something that is designed to sit on a shelf or you know, designed to be looked at or a coffee table book. This is actually an action-oriented, implementable plan. So we're very, very excited about that and the opportunity to use this plan to really make some dramatic improvements on the cohesiveness of the region as a whole.
And you say action, and the goal of the action is to what? Bring more businesses into Northwest Indiana to sell it?
To help grow the economy of Northwest Indiana, whether that's through working with partners to encourage a environment of entrepreneurship and innovation, whether it's attracting new business here, helping the business that's here to grow. You know, and again, this is not a plan for the forum, it's a plan for the region as a whole. So developing workforce and helping attract the workforce that fits in line with the talent that we need to make our companies that are here successful, as well as we diversify our economy and being able to attract the workers that are needed for a more diverse economy. So it is a playbook that we're working across many sectors and with many regional partners on, and talking about how we build upon the double tracking in the Westlake and what those opportunities that the RDA is working so hard on, what they bring to the region and how we then can actuate those into opportunities for company growth and community growth.
So when you've met your goal, what will that look like? How will the region be different and look different?
So, you know, as we talk about aspirations for the region, one of vibrancy and enthusiasm and hope and collaboration and cooperation and with it, where we actually feel like the assets are being well utilized and working in tandem and not so siloed. So I think that we're seeing more and more opportunities for municipalities and organizations to work together to bring some of these things to fruition. And it's really a case of many hands making light work and all of us rowing in the same general direction.
So what assets do you think are siloed? You mean like capitalizing on the new additions and the new improvements at like the Gary Chicago International Airport and things of that nature?
Absolutely. To be able to build on the expanded runway at the airport, as I talked about, to be able to take advantage of the enhanced commuter rail times that will be coming from the double tracking in the Westlake corridor, utilizing the Port of Indiana and really attracting companies or helping companies to expand that can use that as an asset and really helping others to understand what that asset is and how we build upon that. Continuing to tout our great economic climate, but also the wonderful quality of life that we have here in Northwest Indiana and the great work that's being done by many other organizations to continue to improve on that and continue to boost that. So I'm very bullish on the future of Northwest Indiana and excited about what we have as assets and what the opportunities are to continue to build upon those. I think that we haven't lived up to our full potential yet, and I think that's going to continue to grow in the coming years.
So now that you've teamed up with TIP Strategies, which is Austin and Seattle-based, you say, based in Austin and Seattle, what is the next step in the process here?
So we had TIP out in March and again in April, and they've been meeting with stakeholders in the region. We'll be circling back. We have TIP back out at the end of May. They'll be here again in June, July, and then we'll roll out the plan in August. So this is a quick, intensive study of the region and then with an action-oriented plan on the back end. So it is truly the goal is to have something that is workable and can make a dramatic impact with some step-by-step opportunities of how we get there and agreement from the business community and the governmental agencies in the area to say, okay, yeah, this is the direction we want to go and this is how we're going to get there.
That's Heather Ennis, who's the president and CEO of the Northwest Indiana Forum, talking about the creation of a regional economic development strategic playbook. One of the things that have been classified as a pre-existing condition is that of diabetes. And Indiana Public Broadcasting's health reporter, Jill Sheridan, talked to somebody who has the illness and how she is coping with it.
Diabetes is something 69-year-old Alma Trawick knows a lot about.
You can lose your legs, you lose your eyesight. I mean, you know, my mom was a double amputee. She didn't have no legs.
Trawick lives in Indianapolis's Keystone Millersville neighborhood on the near northeast side. Her brother also has the disease. She was diagnosed as type 2 last year.
So when I was 68, and I know why I went over that line, because I stopped exercising and stopped eating right.
She's taken diabetes education classes at her neighborhood YMCA. She gets on the treadmill when she can, but when it comes to food, she says for many in this neighborhood, what's affordable and available often wins out.
We've got Popeye's Chicken, Kentucky Fried Chicken, McDonald's. We have Taco Bell, Long John Silver. We have two other chicken places just on 38th Street in Keystone.
An estimated 11% of Hoosiers live with diabetes. In Trawick's neighborhood, the percentage of diagnosed cases is closer to 17%. It's one of three Indianapolis neighborhoods that will have dedicated health workers through a new diabetes reduction pilot, one that could be extended to other neighborhoods in the state.
We need to make people aware of it. And so it's like, oh my God, I'm a diabetic. You know, it's like the bad thing.
Residents like Trawick will encourage neighbors to engage with the program. IU Richard M. Fairbanks School of Public Health at IUPUI is one of five partners in the Diabetes Impact Project. Dean Paul Halverson says, place matters.
You know, there's over a 14-year difference in life expectancy of a little baby born today in southern Indianapolis, just south of where Lilly headquarters is at, and a baby born in Carmel.
Fairbanks School of Public Health and Eli Lilly are leading the pilot. Halverson says it's unique because it targets specific needs of each neighborhood.
If we can change some things and help them by making a couple of relatively simple changes, it could change their life.
Trawick says when she visits with her neighbors, they tell her about some of the obstacles to better health, like crime.
And a lot of my seniors in my area are always afraid to go outside. You know, with them hiding in their house, they're not getting out getting medical attention. They're not getting out getting exercises.
She says another obstacle is lack of recreation options, especially for children.
They have Washington Park on the south side of 38th Street. But when you have little kids, who's going to send them across 38th Street?
Partners announced the project last spring.
This partnership is significant.
Marion County Public Health Department Director Virginia Kane says the five-year project will identify people with the disease, connect them with care, and support prevention efforts.
We all want to live in a city where your zip code doesn't determine your health. And for the people living in these three neighborhoods, the goal of this is to make a real difference that is felt today and by future generations.
Alma Trawick is excited to spread the word.
Many times there's programs and people don't know about it. And so I'm glad that I'm involved in this because now I know everybody in my area is going to know about it because I'm going to tell them about it.
For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jill Sheridan.
Those wet wipes that you see in the bathroom and use in the bathroom may not be flushable after all. They're clogging sewers and they're sending taxpayer dollars down the drain, so to speak. And as Indiana Public Broadcasting's Rebecca Thiel reports, experts are arguing over which products are to blame.
Open up a sewer lift in the city of Warsaw and you'll find a lot of things. Cigarettes, gum, and many, many wet wipes. Warsaw Wastewater Utility Manager Brian Davison says those wipes aren't breaking down like they should.
Some will clog the pumps, which then cause a sewer backup upstream from that pumping station. So potentially we could have sewer backup into basements, run out onto the ground, and cause problems.
What's more, it's making another problem in Indiana's sewers worse. Warsaw Assistant Utility Manager Larry Hyden says the wipes bind to fats, oils, and grease, which are notorious for their stink. He says he's nearly lost his lunch before.
Probably the worst smell I've been involved in, yes.
Davison says cleaning out these wipes gets expensive, and that cost gets passed on to the residents of Warsaw. He says every time his team gets a call to fix a backup in the middle of the night, it could cost as much as $2,000 in overtime and equipment. But this isn't just happening here, or even in Indiana. Cities all over the country are experiencing these clogs, and some are crafting laws to prevent them. New York City and Washington, D.C. are trying to pass legislation that would change the requirements for wipes to be marketed as flushable. When wastewater workers get together, wipes are a topic of conversation. At this year's Indiana Water Environment Association Challenge in Shelbyville, industry professionals came from all over the state to compete in safety relays.
Position the expanding tool as shown below. You can't abandon until locking is passed.
Jerry Merriman was there. He helps repair the city of Fort Wayne sewer system, which has also had issues with wipes.
If I could, I'd drop it in the front door. That'd kind of let them know really what they shouldn't do, but so far they frown on that.
According to the Association of the Nonwoven Fabrics Industry, only 7% of disposable wipes are marketed as flushable. The problem is, it's hard to tell. Wet wipe companies don't make it that obvious on the packaging.
These are Pampers, and underneath this flap is where it says, do not flush.
That's Bradley Fix, superintendent at Shelbyville Water Resource Recovery Facility. He's also a part of the water quality nonprofit, the Water Environment Federation, or WEF. Fix says WEF has been working with the wipes industry to make bigger logos where customers can see them. Unfortunately, that's about the only thing that industry and wastewater officials can agree on. They have different ideas about what should be considered flushable and how to test products to make sure they dissolve. The wipes industry argues that flushable wipes do break down. It's other disposable wipes that are to blame, like baby wipes. President of the Association of the Nonwoven Fabrics Industry, Dave Roos, points to a 2016 study where objects were sorted in a New York City wastewater facility. We reached him through Skype.
The largest constituent was paper towels in most of the studies. Paper towels, not designed nor marketed to be flushed.
However, the New York Department of Environmental Protection has refuted this study and says it's not representative of what the agency's seen in New York sewers. But even if the study's findings are accurate, wastewater experts say flushable wipes have started a bad trend. Brianne Nakamura of the Water Environment Federation talked to us through Skype.
They were kind of that first category of wipes that were saying, hey, you can flush this, it's allowed, put it down your toilet, it's not a big deal. And they really kind of changed the consumer's perspective of what can go down the toilet.
Back in Warsaw, Larry Hayden says people need to know that simply flushing a wet wipe can cause expensive problems in their communities.
Even though it says flushable on it, doesn't always mean that you should just flush it down the drain, because out of sight, not out of mind for us anyhow.
Hayden says he'll certainly never flush a wet wipe again. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Rebecca Thiel.
Gasoline prices may not go down substantially until the end of the summer driving season. That's when the youngsters are back in school, and it's well past Labor Day. So says GasBuddy.com's Patrick DeHaan.
Well, we'll be constantly seeing the ups and downs. We usually see a pretty big jump in Indianapolis every 1 to 1.5 weeks. That is then followed by a big price drop.
DeHaan says that prices will be in the upper $2 a gallon range, occasionally going over $3 on a limited basis. He says that's due to consistently higher crude oil prices. DeHaan says that he doesn't expect any widespread relief or any more sustainable relief to arrive until the end of the summer driving season. And that is, he says, when the demand for gasoline starts to wane.
And then we'll start to see some relief mid to late September, in which gas prices should be able to stay under $3 a gallon.
DeHaan says that even though you may be hearing about President Trump's considering of keeping the oil reserve and tapping it, relief from that would only be temporary. He's against the idea. DeHaan says that that would lead to only a minuscule and very temporary drops at the gas pumps. Here in Indiana, gasoline is nearly 4 cents a gallon up from last week at $2.92 a gallon. In Fort Wayne, gasoline is up nearly 20 cents a gallon there at $2.97 a gallon. There's been a lot of discussion in recent months and even in the last few years about trying to help build a strong and educatable workforce to be able to take on the jobs of the future here in Indiana. Some of the work is being left, of course, to public schools to try to make revisions in the state's graduation requirements. And that is how the Indiana State Board of Education has gotten involved here, to find a way to help come up with employability skills. And in turn, there's been some changes that are being proposed, some recommendations being made on graduation pathways. That's what the State Board of Education is working on. And we have with us Northwest Indiana's representative on the State Board of Education, Tony Walker. Tony, thank you for being with us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Good afternoon, Chris.
Thank you, and good afternoon to you. Will you kind of give us a little history lesson here on the concerns that have been voiced over the years, or at least certainly before the State Board of Education, about coming up with a workforce that is able to tackle the jobs and the tasks of the future, and how that kind of relates back to how the high schools in Indiana should be dealing with it?
And this was sort of an interesting history, because typically education policy bubbles up to the state level from the field, from the schools and school districts. But this one, I believe, really came more from industry and came from the employers in the state talking to the elected officials about their troubles filling jobs in the state of Indiana, and about the skills of the workforce in Indiana that were showing some concern to a lot of major companies throughout the state that looked to hire workers. And as a result of that, the governor and the State Board of Education and the Indiana General Assembly also came to the conclusion that we needed to change the expectation of high schools in Indiana as to what type of education they're providing kids, and not totally overhaul it and throw out the baby with the bathwater, but right, to make sure that when kids walk across that stage, and a diploma is put in their hand that they can actually do something. Right now, this previously and still right now, the system is sort of slanted toward higher education. But as we know, not all kids are going to go to college, and not all kids are going to even get two-year degrees. So what we as a state board tried to do with graduation pathways is make the high schools responsible for assuring that every student that graduates has some skill set that will allow them to either go on to college or go into the workforce.
When did the State Board of Education get involved in this conversation? Obviously, it's a conversation that started a long time ago in maybe the individual school districts around the state, or in the state employment agencies and the like, that decided this is the people that we have to work with, and these are the jobs that have to be filled, but the education skills are not there as they should be. When was the discussion first brought up, as best as you can tell?
Well, really, you know, education policy is really controlled by the governor of the state. So the conversation's been going on for many, many years under many different governors. But it was Governor Hochul, when he came in, that really said, we're going to address this issue and make it a priority. And within his first year, the state board actually changed the policy and the graduation requirements to put graduation pathways out front.
Tell us how the system is set up right now with recommendations have been made and ones that have been offered that I guess the State Board of Education will consider in more detail later if need be. How the graduation pathway seems to be shaped up right now?
Well, we've had a tremendous outpouring of support and participation from educators all throughout the state in putting together what we just adopted last week as a guidance document to school districts to actually implement graduation pathways. I mean, there was a phenomenal number of educators and school districts participating in the development of that doctrine. And where we're at now is trying to encourage school districts to not wait until, you know, for the two-year period or so when it has to be implemented, and try to set systems up now and start forming partnerships with local industry, partnerships with local nonprofits to provide the work-based learning and service-based learning experiences for kids immediately. It's being phased in. So right now, for instance, this graduating class still had to pass our examination in order to get their diploma. Otherwise, they'd have to get a waiver. So we're getting rid of that one-size-fits-all kind of testing out of high school requirement. And so you won't have that test now that you have to pass to graduate, at least the statewide test. And instead, we're looking now for more hardcore evidence that you have developed not only work experience, but service-based experience and project-based learning experiences, which hopefully will help students develop not only hard skill sets, but soft skill sets that would make them have a smoother transition either into the workforce or into college.
If you will, take us down the options here in a little more detail here. You mentioned starting out about the work-based learning. Tell us more about that and what you're hoping with the employability skills that's put these benchmarks into place, how state school systems as well as the employers can take advantage of that.
And that's going to be part of the challenge of the implementation, particularly in some of our smaller districts in more rural areas. I don't think we'll have as tough a time with implementation here. But sort of what the expectation is that school districts will start forming partnerships with local industry, whether it's U.S. Steel or whatever is in your area, particular area, to develop some opportunities for students to come in and perform internships, for them to get together, say, with United Way, have a partnership with United Way where maybe they go and help do some service projects in their area, where all of that now is credited towards the graduation requirements for public service experiences that the student has, workplace learning experiences that the student has. And then also we're encouraging the school districts within the classroom to move to more of a project-based learning experience and move away from the model slowly but surely of just sitting students in the classroom and talking to them for a 55 minutes or 60 minute period and then sending them home with homework, and looking to have it to be more of a hands-on interdisciplinary experience while they're in the classroom facilitated by the teacher.
Now, I recall when I was in high school, I had opportunities, and some of my fellow students had the opportunities to take advantage of being able to get your classwork done a little early and then take off as long as you were going to a job of some type. Is that something that's being emphasized again to encourage the fact that school districts make room for students to be able to have a job? It might be a benefit to them to what they can learn to be able to find a career in the future?
Yeah, and I think you've just touched upon what's going to be one of the probably biggest challenges in implementing it, is that we're going to have to relook at how schools do their scheduling, whether or not they use block scheduling or whatever kind of scheduling format to make room for students to be in and out of the building throughout the course of the day. So I think in many ways it's going to go back to what you just explained your experience was, but even probably more of that.
Do you think that even with the changes that are being proposed here to go to opportunities where you've got pathway options like work-based learning, as we've just kind of referred to here, where you have a chance to not only take your classes in school, but also go work in the afternoons, we'll say, at some job, and then service-based learning, as you mentioned, being involved in a civic or a volunteer experiences along with your classroom training, and then of course, the project-based learning, which is what you're hoping to go to, will this change anything dramatically, in your opinion, based on what the current pathway is? That is, and we know that it's kind of a veering off a bit, to go into a pathway where a graduate will in turn get his high or her high school diploma or certificate of some kind, and that will kind of aim them perhaps toward higher education, but hopefully first be ready for a job.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a dramatic change because you're going to have more and more students graduating, number one, with college credits, because part of this also is really trying to focus on dual credit programs, which I think are really going to pick up as a result of this as well. So I think you'll have more and more kids, particularly in their junior or senior years, maybe spending part of the day at their high school and then part of the day at Ivy Tech or Indiana University Northwest or Purdue Northwest. So you're going to have a lot more of that going on. But you're also going to have kids that are now not only graduating with a diploma, but are graduating with industry certifications, which will allow them to go and get much more higher paying jobs within the state of Indiana.
Do you think this is also a given opportunity, maybe people hadn't thought of before, to be involved in apprenticeships for some of the trades that still offer apprenticeships?
Absolutely. And that's one of the things that I'm working on right now with our state board. Because currently we don't have a technical education concentrator in plumbing and pipe fitting.
Right.
So I'm trying to establish now in the state of Indiana a pathway for plumbing and pipe fitting. Because I have a lot of friends that are plumbers and pipe fitters, and you know what? They're always in demand.
Well, that's what you would think.
The world, apparently.
We're noticing that there's always a demand for plumbers and pipe fitters. There's always a demand for well-experienced carpenters and joiners and some of the other trades, construction trades in particular. We want to see more houses go up, more office buildings go up, and then get them filled. But somebody has to build those.
Absolutely. And that's one of the first meetings I'm looking forward to have is with Northwest Indiana Building Trades Council. As soon as we can get the foundation set and the state approval for having a plumbing and pipe fitting pathway, to see if we can come up with some program that is sort of a precursor to entering into the union trades program up here.
We're talking with Tony Walker, who is Northwest Indiana's representative on the Indiana State Board of Education. The Board of Education is dealing with graduation pathways options that are being made available and being discussed these days. We've talked about the way to help make the young people more employable in the workforce as they finish up their high school and maybe some college experience to get a certificate of some type. What kind of changes, if any, are planned in the options for those who are maybe actually going to continue on and head on to college? Any changes in the benchmarks that they're facing, the SATs, the ACTs, the other exams they might have to face?
There are changes that I think are going to really help our graduating college-bound seniors. One, for instance, we're looking at changing our 10th grade standardized test to the actual SAT, and hopefully we'll be able to work it out with the General Assembly for the state to actually cover the cost for students to take that SAT. The other thing, or SAT, ACT, or one of those tests, it hasn't been determined which one yet.
Uh-huh.
But I'm just saying the ones that people know.
I'm sure that there are probably a lot of details that have yet to be worked out, that a lot of this has had some good options that have been offered, but in the discussion, the recommendations that have been made, but you have to come down to actually how to practice this.
Yeah, and the other thing is we're really looking to have strong partnerships with our local state universities. I mean, Ivy Tech has been a great partner, as has Purdue, Northwest, and IUN. So I think there will be more linkages between the local school districts and those universities to assist kids to get more college credits while still in high school. And there's one school, 21st Century Charter School in Gary, that actually pays the fees for their students to take those courses. I don't know how many other school districts actually do that, but that's a possibility. But in every case, those fees are subsidized, and they're cheaper to accrue. It's cheaper to accrue those college credits on a high school dual credit track than it is if you were actually enrolled in the college. So you get the added benefit of, I think you're going to have a lot more high schoolers graduating with a year, and maybe some of them even 2 years of college credit under their belt, that have been either significantly subsidized or paid for them.
Tony, you're here in Northwest Indiana, so you get to see an area that is still, even though it's reduced in size, still a pretty much industrial area. How do you get to cope in some of these questions that come up and in turn interact, I suppose, with your colleagues on the State Board of Education in some of the other counties elsewhere in Indiana, say in central Indiana, where we find more technology-based jobs and related things, certainly involving higher education? How do you get to be able to see how these pathways are going to be able to, be accomplished in some of these other counties of the state?
Well, one of the things, we have great accountability because we are relying heavily and working on this with Indiana's Department of Workforce Development. That's one of the things I think Governor Holcomb has done that's been unique to his tenure, is pretty much bringing together the workforce development community and the education community totally. We're pretty much working hand in hand in everything. So we have constant access to their data. For instance, you know, they tell us that by 2020, 65% of all Hoosier jobs are going to require some type of training beyond high school. So in planning out all of these processes, as well as in assisting school districts to plan out their pathways, we're all working very closely with workforce development and the data they have. So we will be able to see the economic impact as far as jobs, employability, and all of that directly through our interaction with workforce development.
Now, do you and your colleagues on the State Board of Education feel confident that the pathway requirements are going to be able to be ready for the graduating class of 2023 as the goal is?
Oh, I'm confident they're going to be ready before then.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that I'm really happy that we did with the pathways is we provided local school districts a lot of flexibility in terms of developing their own locally created pathways. I made a joke at one of our meetings that, hey, maybe Carmel will come up with the career professional tennis pathway. But
well, that's possible.
Up here, I'll say maybe Munster can come up with the professional tennis pathway. But we've given a lot of flexibility for school districts to basically develop this around the resources they have in their communities and the interests of their students. And we have already begun approving locally created pathways. And so I think from what we've been hearing from the field and seeing at our meetings, the school districts are taking this very seriously and getting ahead of it.
Tony Walker, thank you very much for spending time with us to explain what has been discussed in much detail. Hope to have you back again soon. Tony Walker is a Northwest Indiana representative from the State Board of Education. Michigan City Area Schools' Kruger Middle School is set up to study environmental sciences, and the students there have already made inroads in recycling and composting. Environmental sciences teacher Daisy Lee was with us on Regionally Speaking not long ago to talk more about the successful spring semester programs that will continue into the next school year.
Kruger Middle School is a public environmentally themed middle school here in Michigan City, and we have environmental science classes, which is required for all students, along with their regular science class. So they get a full year of regular science, and then they get a half a year, so one semester of environmental science, mm-hmm. both in 7th and 8th grade. And if they pass environmental science with an A or B, then they get high school credits for that. We also have environmental shop class, environmental computer class, environmental art class, and about 113 acres of land, including woods, that we, our students in the environmental shop class have made four different trail systems for our community to use, but also we host environmental field days every year where we invite our first through sixth graders from the district and our seventh and eighth graders go out on the trails with them and teach them different environmental activities.
Wow, that sounds like it's got quite a program for folks in Michigan City and certainly the students who attend the schools there at Michigan City Area Schools.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a great program.
The things we wanted to focus on in our conversation today, first off, start in talking about a very interesting and rather innovative food recycling program that is underway. And I know this is a program that's kind of in hiatus right now, I imagine, because it's the summer break. But during the regular academic year, it seems to be going full blast, it seems like. And I understand the program is something that you helped start back in April. Tell us about how the food recycling program got started and the different stages or components, maybe might be a better way to describe it, that this program has going for it.
We've been trying to compost in the cafeteria for a couple of years now, but haven't quite found the correct system. And so this year, I came up with the 5-stage system. So I made signs for kids to follow. So the first stage was the share table. So any unopened food that they hadn't eaten, that they hadn't touched, that goes in the share table. Then we had composting buckets where they would put all of their open food or food that they've already taken a bite out of. That goes in those buckets. And that also included meat and cheese and milk, which is something that doesn't go in a traditional compost because it creates terrible smells and it can attract critters. But our compost bin is far enough away from the school and it's reinforced with chicken wire so that critters can't get in and it doesn't smell. So the goal of our compost is to reduce the amount that we're putting into the landfill.
Uh-huh.
And so stage 3 is recycling. So anything else that can be recycled, any cans, any plastic bottles. But also at that station, we partner with an organization called TerraCycle, and they take materials that you can't normally recycle. So chip bags, for example. So we also collect chip bags and we put those to the side, and then TerraCycle pays for shipping for us to send them the chip bags, and then we earn points with them, which we can then exchange for money to go back to the school. And then station 4 is your regular garbage, which not much ended up there.
I imagine not.
Basically the plastic silverware. That was a lot of it. And then station 5 was the plastic trays that they used to carry all of their food on.
Oh, wow. So it sounds like this is a good comprehensive way to be able to deal with not only everything that normally would get tossed out and end up in the landfill or maybe nominally recycled, I would imagine. Like you say, you're able to recycle some things that would say that the Michigan City Community Recycling Program couldn't take in. It sounds like, and especially in the case of the plastic bags and things like that. And I also, too, want to bring into one of the other components that you mentioned as well, too, that you're able to kind of partner with a community business to help take care of some of the food scraps that the students leave behind from the cafeterias as well. Let's go into a little more detail here, Daisy Lee, about these various areas. If people are not familiar with the share table, and then they've probably seen it at their school cafeteria if they have youngsters that attend, and maybe they've been in there during lunchtime, they see things there. The share table is a pretty popular place, I would imagine, because some youngsters have a chance to kind of pick and choose something that maybe they didn't necessarily like that was on their tray ahead of time, or when they went through line, I guess, they can find something else that might be tasty. And in this case, too, if it's not being eaten at all, it's gone to some good use. How much material comes in on the average at the share table?
Originally, before we had this system going, we were getting, I don't know, 5 to 10 bags of apples each day, and then a few bananas and a couple of other random things, because kids were just throwing everything away.
Right.
That, you know, that's all they knew, and it's not their fault, right? They didn't know. And so they were throwing everything away. But with this system, they had to put everything on their tray exactly where it belongs. And I also had 7th and 8th grade volunteers help me with the stations. So they would volunteer each day and stand at the stations and help the kids understand what goes where. And so with the share table, they can put all their unopened and uneaten food. And so kids would come up and take whatever they wanted if they wanted something extra. But everything left over, the cafeteria staff would then hold until the end of the week in their fridge, and then on Friday they would donate it to a local homeless shelter.
Is this an idea maybe you've heard about from other school districts, or was this something that maybe the folks in the community said, hey, you know, we'd like to get more material to go to the homeless shelters to help the folks that have to use the shelters out?
This was started by our cafeteria staff before the composting, so they'd been doing this for months, and we didn't even know about it. In the fall, we will start right back up at day one. And this year, I made sure to train 7th and 8th graders who are interested, and I took volunteers.
That's Mission City environmental science teacher Daisy Lee. Time once again for another edition of Eye on the Arts, and here's John Kane with South Shore Arts.
Joining me for this edition of Eye on the Arts is Kirk Muspratt, music director and conductor of the Northwest Indiana Symphony Orchestra, here to tell us about the South Shore Summer Music Festival for 2018.
Good morning, John. And yes, I'm very excited. The orchestra is very excited. We have 7 wonderful concerts this summer, looking to, you know, give music to everyone in the community, everybody of all ages, and have some wonderful evenings together.
We're in a ton of communities this mm-hmm. year. We have... Well, thanks to this lead sponsorship of the John W. Anderson Foundation, we're able to perform in one additional community under the umbrella of the festival,
right,
which is the Indiana Dunes,
right,
Lakeshore at West Beach. And then we've got the concert in Valparaiso that's sponsored. It's not an official under our umbrella, but it's because it's presented by the Porter County Community Foundation and BMO Harris Bank. But it's the same concert.
Same concert, yeah.
So our sponsors for the South Shore Summer Music Festival are the John W. Anderson Foundation, Strachan Van Til, J.P. Morgan Chase, the Hammond Port Authority, and I wish I knew the exact name of the clean air program that's out of NERPC.
Yeah.
But we're really glad to have all of their help with this.
No kidding.
It enables us to bring these concerts to the communities for free.
Yeah.
So we are going to be asking for a free will offering this year for the first time.
For the first time, because it costs us so much to, you know, just for the truck, for the music.
Yeah.
For instance, John, you know, we're going to do Mission Impossible.
Yes.
And my first, you know, because it was something really requested, lots and lots and lots and lots. So as I bring it to you in the budget and I tell you it's $1,100 to rent it mm-hmm. for 2.5 minutes.
Yeah.
You know,
and then I keel over.
Yeah, you keel over. So a good news that I didn't tell you until this morning is we found one for $70.
Oh, I like that price. Much better, though. That's so much better. I can rest.
Yeah.
I can sleep at night.
Yeah, but people don't know just how much the concerts cost us for setup, for sound, for lighting, for advertising, for security, you know, all sorts of things that go on. And this, you mentioned, John, do you want to, you will talk about this better than I will. Can you talk about the passing of the hat this summer, just so we don't go,
Well, that was it, just that we're going to ask for a free will offering among our audience members, because because we need the help.
Yeah.
You know, these were very uncertain times going into this summer and going into the 2018-19 season coming up in the fall, because it's the first year without the Star Plaza Theater. Mm-hmm. And also the first year without Bethel Church, where we perform classical concerts since 2010. So we're asking everybody to follow the music.
Yes.
And hang in there with us as we move our programming to Monbeck Auditorium in Highland and Living Hope Church in Merrillville and Valparaiso High School as well. But we should talk about the summer concerts quickly.
Sure.
They start on July 21st.
They do, in Cedar Lake, and a great place to play. Lovely, you know, just great. Our next concert is the next Saturday, July 28th, in Crown Point. Then we have our next Saturday, which is in Griffith, on the 4th of August.
Yes, but the night before.
The night before is our first Friday night concert at the Dunes. Yeah.
Okay.
So on the 3rd of August, the Dunes. On the 4th of August, Griffith. Then on the 8th, we go to Valpo, which is a Wednesday evening.
Yes.
Then Friday the 10th, we're in Wolf Lake. And our last concert is on August the 11th in Schererville.
Yes.
And I did try to do just what you were speaking of, John, in putting the concerts together. For instance, next year our education concert is going to be all about Sleeping Beauty, which the kids love. They love the music.
Beautiful
they love the
music.
Story. And so we'll do one piece of Sleeping Beauty, and I will talk about the education concerts a little bit. I'm going to do some things like E.T. and from Star Wars and things to advertise our outer space concert next year, which is the 50th anniversary of the moon landing.
Right.
And that's at the end of our season next year.
Right.
So things like that. We're going to do Tchaikovsky next year. So I put some Tchaikovsky on the beginning of the program and some Rachmaninoff. But there's all kinds of music. I mean, at some point, we're going to do a new version of America the Beautiful, which was premiered at Carnegie Hall a couple years ago, and it is just gorgeous. So we have some patriotic music, but we're going to do some country and western. We're going to do some hoedown-y type music, some country and western music, and there'll be lots of, I hope, new things as far as film music. We've never done Prince of Thieves. For the kids, we've never done How to Train Your Dragon, those kinds of things.
Well, it sounds like it'll be a lot of fun.
It is fun.
Some new stuff.
Yeah.
Good. All right, Kirk. Well, thanks for being here to tell us about the upcoming South Shore Summer Music Festival. Thank you for listening. We'll be back again next week with another edition of Eye on the Arts.
And you can hear this conversation and previous editions of Eye on the Arts online on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org. And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks for joining us. Hope you'll be with us tomorrow. Our guest will be Indiana University Northwest economist Micah Pollack.